This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Shaw, and this is episode 295 with Rakim Cunningham. He is an artist working in photography based here in Los Angeles, currently in northern San Fernando Valley section, which we talk quite a bit about, and much, much more. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of, I hope, Rakim's studio, his work, including his self-portraiture, and more. Yeah, welcome to the show. Very short intro today before we launch into the episode and into this Memorial Day weekend as I record. I want to tell you a little bit more about the new phase of the podcast upcoming, and also Clubhouse for just a moment. But first, I want to thank Ali Widows and Lydia Kegler for their contributions, particularly Lydia Kegler, who is on the verge of leaving the show because of grad school and other responsibilities. Just want to give her a big thank you for all the work that she's contributed to the show. And she worked primarily in booking for the show. So if that's something that you're at all curious and or interested about, please do reach out to us and we'll talk. Also, many thanks to those of you who are ongoing supporting the show on Patreon. You too can do so for as little as a dollar a month, though certainly $2 or $5 or even $10 is very much appreciated. You can also support the show by donating one time via PayPal, Venmo, old-fashioned check. All that can be found on the website, theconversationpod.com/support. And as you may already know, you can support us non-financially by leaving a great review on our Apple Podcast page, by following us at Artist Podcast on Instagram. You can also follow me at Michael Shaw Art there. And thank you very much in advance. And you can also spread the word, of course. So Clubhouse, which is the sort of smartphone-based group chat app that's become all the rage with many in the art community included. It's kind of like a impromptu, often drop-in to conversations, like a party chat, right, from the 80s or 90s, but about focused topics or about random topics. I would like to host one very soon. If anybody wants to help me do that this Memorial Day weekend, let's drop one in on Sunday or Monday for an hour of conversation. Just help me come up with a topic. Shoot me a DM, an email, a Clubhouse message. That's not actually possible, apparently. And we'll drop in to Clubhouse with a little conversation-hosted event for an hour. So keep an eye out. If it doesn't happen, in any case, do connect with me on Clubhouse, and hopefully we will do something very soon, if not this very weekend. And again, we will do another conversation virtual cafe, which we've done 11 or 12 of now, hopefully in the next couple of weeks as well. Finally, before we jump to the episode, for those of you who don't know, I am conceptual envisioning and working towards a new phase of this podcast. Could even be another podcast altogether, but in any case, it's definitely art-related, contemporary art-related, and the team is almost all in place. I think there's room for maybe one more, maybe two more at most. We're going to be doing scripted narrative stories with definitely opinion-oriented as well, or included. So if that sounds intriguing to you and you would like to get in on the ground floor, please reach out and I will tell you more. I'm hoping, God willing, that we can launch the first one along with episode 300. So that's not very far away, but fingers crossed we can do it. If not, you know, we'll do it when we do it. All right. I hope you guys are well. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for listening. If you are listening as this releases, I hope you're having a great Memorial Day weekend. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, be well. Ciao for now. Okay. And you are a lifelong Angeleno. right?
That's correct.
Right, yeah. And you are still, well, sorry, I don't know if still is an appropriate word to use, but you live in the town where you grew up now, correct?
I do, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Right. What's been the history there? Have there been urges to leave at various points? Have you like come around again? You know, what's kind of been the arc of that relationship, you and your hometown?
Yeah, it's been interesting because, yeah, growing up in Pacoima, it's very small, you know, and it's not a lot of people here. I went to a Christian school, actually, where the total population of the school from kindergarten until 12th grade was like 300 people. Mm. Yeah, so it was really small, but I'm really attached to it, you know, like my little like 5 mile stretch of Foothill Boulevard. Mm. But I think it's, you know, I think it's really nice. And yeah, in terms of moving, I left to go to Westwood for UCLA, and then I lived out there for a bit and came back. I've been here mostly because my studio. So my family has a lot of like contractors in it and things like that. And so we actually ended up like building a studio that's connected to my kitchen that's under my bedroom, essentially. Huh. And it's just, yeah, it's like all white walls and there's like one window. And so I essentially do a lot of my work there. And because I have the studio right here, it's like, why would I leave?
Right.
And also LA is so expensive, you know, right. It's kind of like, I think one of the things that's kind of that a lot of artists like feel ashamed about is money. And like, you know, it's hard to have a full-time art practice, like a job, and, you know, have all that stuff I want. So I'm trying to, at this point in my life, give myself like some self-compassion and just be like, look, like, you know, I have plans to move now, but it's like, it is what it is. And I like my little town, and I like that, you know, there's like the local barber shops that I've gone to since I've been like 14. And I like that there's like the same thrift stores and all of that. And also for a lot of the work, I buy a lot of the materials within, you know, that like a 20 mile radius of where I live, mostly because I feel like it's so off the map and no one really knows where it is that I want to, I don't know, like have a little part of it in the work, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's close to my heart and I'm very protective of it.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like hometown pride.
Pretty much, you know, like, you know, it's not like there's not a lot of stuff over here, but I think the people here work really hard. I think they're all amazing people, like, and they all are just trying to do the best that they can. And my family came from Alabama and moved out here. And, you know, I've never really like thought about like how other people are, but I quite like, you know, where I'm at in this little spot that I am. And I'm slowly at 29, like expanding my worldview. So it, you know, you can like take the boy out of the small town. And so now I'm trying to just keep the small town as I'm like expanding and moving on, you know?
Mm. What do you call your small town?
Oh, I just call it Pacoima, you know,
Pacoima,
like,
yeah,
it's just like Pacoima, Lakeview Terrace and like Sylmar are kind of like all the same city for the most part.
Yeah, totally. And presumably with that setup, you get along with your family or have gotten along with your family. And that's why it is a sweet setup, right?
You would think that.
Okay.
You know, I think as yes, like I definitely, you know, don't. Like, we're not, like, contentions and at each other's throats. But I think that there are definitely differences and there are definitely things that are hard about living at home as you get older. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, the older I get, and for example, like, a lot of the work that I do is nude self-portraiture or, like, nudity is, like, a part of it. And I have in the studio, I made sure that I got like privacy glass doors because, you know, it's like one thing and it's like connected to my kitchen. So it's one thing, you know, to like be doing photos, but I don't want like my sister or, you know, like my mom or whatever, like running up and then seeing, you know, me like posing half naked, like in the studio. So it's like something like that. And also too, like I'm the only gay person in my family, as far as I know. And so that has been interesting, because I think there's a lot of like cultural differences when it comes to that. And so it's taken, you know, time and effort, but I think as I get older, we're starting to communicate a lot more. And that's something that I'm trying to learn in my everyday life now, you know, like communication and talking to people about differences. So mm-hmm. that and, you know, like drugs. mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. fine.
Yeah. Say more. What about the drugs? Is that something you also have to have conversations about, or is that something you more keep?
Oh, yourself? No, it's fine. It's whatever. Like, I just smoke weed sometimes. And like when I'm in the studio, like that's really it. That's mostly. Yeah.
And you've been referring to it as my kitchen. Do you mean that literally, or is that just like your shared kitchen?
It's like our shared kitchen. It's just it's interchangeable. It's just I've been here for so long that it's just like it's just second nature to say my.
Right.
Yeah. Probably means it's time to leave.
It's not like a compound with like multiple apartments or anything like that. And
kitchens. No. It's like a 3-bedroom house, and like we each have a bedroom. Right. It's like middle class. Like there's like a backyard type of thing. So sure. it's like a quite a nice setup. So I'm like really happy and grateful with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do pay rent. So like I'm just like, you know what, since I'm paying rent, let me just leave and pay rent somewhere else.
Right. So when did you start paying rent?
A few years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been paying rent for a minute. Mostly I would say like once I kind of got more secure in like in my day job, is when that started happening. And I also think it's just like a respect thing. Like if I'm going to be in your house, I think it's, you know, the right thing to do to like help pay for things. So that's just, I don't know. That's just like kind of how we were. Like, you know, they always joke about like, oh, well, you're going to like use up all my light or do this or blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and it's like, no, like it's okay. Don't worry about it. Like I'm going to pay you for all the food and all that stuff. And like, I'll buy my own stuff. Don't worry about it. And yeah, you know, but it, in terms of like art making, it's been great because I can make work whenever I want, and that's mm-hmm. what's really exciting.
Yeah. Do you have moments of inspiration where you like go down out your kitchen and down into your studio and do something like in the middle of the night or, you know, whenever?
All the time. Really? I sleep in here sometimes too.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah. I have like an air mattress that I keep in my trunk, and if I get really inspired, like sometimes if I'm doing a show or like a body of work or a project that I'm really excited about, I'll blow up the air mattress and like sleep in the studio for like 3 days straight.
Huh.
And it has different locks than like the other rooms in the house.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, I'm the only person that has keys to it. So I kind of think of the studio as like a almost like sacred space, like a safe space mm-hmm. where I can, you know, like be myself and do all of that. So yeah, like there are tons of times where I come home from work or I have a like fit of inspiration on the weekend and I'll go in and shoot for like 2 hours. Sometimes that's at 7 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes it's at like midnight. I think the latest I've done a shoot is like 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
So it really kind of depends.
Right. And yeah. You have visitors in there presumably occasionally, right?
Sometimes, but I try to keep it like really minimal. As weird as this is, I don't really like a lot of people in here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know why. I think it's just more because it's like my area and like right now that's kind of important for me. So I have people that come in, like my gallerist and all of that will come in and, you know, like friends or whatnot when I'm doing shoots. But for the most part, it's kind of hidden and like the people that I live next to don't really know it's here.
Right.
And I kind of like it like that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
people don't bother me.
Yeah. So you are, as you kind of briefly mentioned, your day job is actually working at a gallery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you're the director? Is that your title?
No.
Oh, what's your title?
Oh, my God. If I said that, you'd be like, what are you talking? No, I'm the gallery manager.
The gallery manager, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I was confusing with director. Okay.
Yeah.
How long has that been going on?
Yeah, so I started working, so I don't mind saying it, I work at Gavlak. Right. I started working there in August of 2020 during the pandemic, and it's actually been really great. It's been a really nice learning experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was leaving a job that was not the best, to put it lightly. I was, people that know me know where I work, but I used to work at a gallery for 5 years. That's like an artist collective. And over time, it just started to get very, like, at least for me, toxic and kind of like abusive in terms of like work policies. And like when COVID started, it was just like, you know, like I had to like track hours and just like, I don't know. And just all kind of like weird stuff in board meetings. And I just ended up, you know, my mental health kind of suffered. And I left and I actually just like got a list of galleries that I really respected, and Gavlak was on the list, and I just cold called. I cold called them all one day. I just took 2 weeks off of work. Like I had like a vacation, like so much vacation time. I took 2 weeks off of work and I just called all these galleries like, are you guys hiring? Are you hiring?
Right.
And my plan was, if I can't find a job at the end of this 2 weeks, then like I just have to quit and not have a job anymore. But luckily it worked out, and it's been great. And working with Sarah has been great. And seeing like how a gallery of that level like operates, and being able to be a part of that, and also like share artists that I know with them, and, you know, like be able to help produce so many artist shows of like queer work. And Gavlak focuses on LGBTQ artists and women artists, so being able to work and focus on that has been really, really exciting. And it's nice to be able to like work at a place where you respect the artists that are there, and you know, they're really great about like my art practice as well. Like I don't bring it up as much, but like if it comes up, they've been really kind and, you know, like giving helpful hints and tips and stuff like that. So it's been nice.
That is nice. One of the many challenges of working in a gallery as an artist is that you feel like you're not recognized as an artist. You're only recognized for what you're doing there, right? So
yeah,
it sounds ideal that, you know, that you found and you know, a gallery that's big enough but also small enough where you can be recognized and you can contribute the way you've been contributing. I mean, I think that's pretty unusual, don't you?
I do. It's a balance for sure. And it's like, it's interesting because like there is a show that's coming up where like one of the artists that I work with is like, and me are in the same show. And so like so that kind of stuff is sometimes not for me, sometimes can get awkward because I get really embarrassed about it at work. But yeah, I mean, I it's great. And what's been incredible is that like it's been such a great opportunity just to like meet people and learn more about art. Like growing up, I didn't know that much about art. And so being able to be like surrounded by art in my daily life, like every day at my job and then at my studio, it's pretty incredible. So I'm really happy for that balance. And I'm happy that it's worked out so far and that there's been no issues.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
What kind of things are you doing as a gallery manager? I mean, you're not the director, right? But it sounds like you do have an opportunity to weigh in and have an opinion too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely like a team effort, but my job is mostly like shipping, like consignments, like a lot of like logistics and stuff like that. Like I'm essentially like the registrar.
That's what I was going to say.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I do all that stuff. I like sometimes will like, I help like produce the shows and like I run the installations and all that kind of stuff. So, it's great because, I don't have to be on the sales team because that is so stressful.
Right.
And it's nice because I get to, you know, like be up and close with the art, which is what I love about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you learned a lot of the foundations of what you're describing at your previous job, would you say? I mean, is that why they hired you?
You know, what's so funny is I got hired at that job when I was 22. So I had no idea about like any gallery thing whatsoever. Like, I know that like with them, what they did was they put like red dots when something was sold. And I've seen that, you know, kind of throughout. And I kind of know that now. But before, I remember, like, I had no idea what that was. I didn't know gallery etiquette. Like, I didn't know anything like that, which honestly, I'm kind of grateful for because I think that, like, the gallery world has a lot of work to do. What's the best way to say this? I think the gallery world has a lot of work to do when it comes to, like, how they treat people who are outside of the art world, if that makes sense.
And I think that
because I came from outside of the art world, like a lot of stuff that like that I think people just assume, you know, like I didn't know. So it helps at work because, you know, I'm like super patient with people. I love talking to people. And one of my favorite things is like, I love when Black people come into the gallery. I love to say hi. Like, right. I'm always like, hi, like, do you want a tour? Like, and it's just one of my favorite things because I never got to experience that. So, right. You know, it's definitely like a learning experience for sure. And every day I'm learning something new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're really selling the gallery as a welcoming to newbies type environment, you know, and that's true. We've talked about this on the show before that, you know, there's this whole gestalt or shtick with galleries being intimidating, you know, and that like we don't, if you're not a collector, you know, or you're not somebody who's going to serve us, you know, we don't want to pay attention to you. You know, there are many ways you can spin it, but like there's that whole, you know, unfriendly desk person vibe and all of that, which I'm sure you experience at some point.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. All the time. And that's why I love, you know, working there. And that's why I'm like with Ochi Projects, because I think Polly and Sarah, what they have in common is they're just people who love art and they love to share art with others. And it doesn't matter your background or where you came from, or, you know, like what neighborhood you grew up in, how much money you have. Like if you come in, like people say hi. And I think that that's important, you know, like when I did go start going to galleries, you know, one of the things I did after I got my first job when I was younger was I started going to openings every week because I wanted to learn more, you know, and I wanted to be better at my job. And I wanted to, working at the gallery made me want like an art career for myself for the first time, I would say. And so I was like, okay, I need to learn how to, you know, how things work. And so I would go to galleries and people would not say hi to me. They would act like, you know, like people would ask like, oh, like, do you belong here? I've had times at work where people have handed me keys to ask me to park their car.
At your current job, they've done that?
No. At my old job. Oh. At my old job. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. At my old job, people have come up to me, like handed me their keys. At my new job, I've had people like come in into the building and be like, oh, like, do you belong here? Do you know where you're going? Because it doesn't seem like you do. Stuff like that. And they don't, and like, they didn't know that I worked there. And I was like, oh, no, I actually work here. And they were like, oh, okay. And
did they apologize?
It was one of those things where they were really embarrassed. And then we just haven't like said anything about it. Okay. You know,
yeah.
And it's just one of those things where it's like, it's a microaggression and it's like, I can expend my energy dealing with this shit, or I can just like keep it pushing. And, you know, when you're working at a gallery, that's like on the level of Gav, like is like, there's so much going on. It's like, sometimes it's just easier just to like push past it, you know, like I'll give myself a break and then I'll like journal about it later or something like that. But unfortunately that's one of the issues. I think it happens all the time. You know, people walk like, and I see it like I've seen it so many times at so many openings where like I've gone to openings and the only Black people there are like the security or like, you know, or it's only one or two Black people there. And like, you know, we try to find each other and huddle because, you know, everyone is like acting weird or whatever. Like it's a weird thing. And I think that as time goes on and hopefully I think as more, like emerging artists and as the art world kind of, I think like pays attention to more emerging artists, that this is something that people talk about, because I don't want to work for or like be represented by a gallery that's, you know, mean to people that look like me or whatever. And, you know, that's fucked up.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last gallery where you worked and somebody gave you their keys to try to park their car, and that's where you worked for 5 years.
That's where I worked for 5 years.
Got it. Okay.
The reason I quit was because I got a letter from that person telling me that I needed to respect their authority as the like gallery president because my 5 years of experience doesn't matter, and that I need to like respect his decision making power, and I needed to sign it immediately. Otherwise, I would be suspended without pay during a pandemic, while the Black Lives Matter marches were going on.
Wow.
And I was pretty much like throwing up every morning. I was hating going to work. So right. That's kind of like the context around it.
Wow.
And what made it horrible was that like I would be gaslit. Like we'd be in these meetings and it'd be like, you know, like let's do this or let's do that or whatever. And I'm like, well, this isn't a good idea. You know, like, I don't think this is a great idea. You shouldn't really do that, you know, for XYZ reason. If you want to be seen as a respectable gallery, blah, 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 blah. And it would just be like, oh, well, why are you disrupting, like, the membership? Like, my job is to do this. And yeah, so that was just kind of like the last, straw. You know, Michael, it's been interesting because I've thought about this and I've been like, you know, Rakim, you're a nice person, like, try to be nice to people. You're always like trying to go out of your way. But I think it's fair to talk about like when you're mistreated, you know, I think that that's important. And I think it's important for Black people and Black artists and queer Black artists to speak about those things. And I was in a really horrible situation where, like, you know, I wasn't being listened to, and like, I told people and no one did anything. And, you know, and it came to a point where, like, I was sick, you know, and I mentioned in our, you know, pre-call that, like, I have OCD and, like, my mental health was failing and I wasn't making work. I started doubting all my decisions. And, you know, when you, like, make a mailer to go out and, like, you're told that it's, you know, that it's not designed well, but you have a design degree and the other person that's telling you doesn't, and, like, you've done all the, it's just very weird, you know? And I, at this point, I don't care about, like, talking about things that happened because it's happened. And if people, you know, don't like it, then, like, you shouldn't have done it. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. Why don't we talk a little bit about what we talked about last time, which is your unusual sort of delay in completing your degree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you sort of give whatever you think is the most appropriate setup and kind of take us to that point, and then I can maybe ask you a couple questions if that's all right.
Yeah, of course. I graduated from UCLA this past year with my BFA in Design and Media Arts. But I started school in 2010, and then I kind of, you know, quote, like, left in 2014. And I only had like two classes left, and then I ended up getting my job, that my old job, and I just started working for the most part. And over time, I just kind of became ashamed of not finishing, and it felt like if I just ignored it and just continued to just work really hard, that, you know, that feeling of being like a failure will go away. And it didn't. And it got worse as time goes on. And I just kind of pushed it back because I was like, I didn't want to deal with those emotions. But in quarantine, I think having to sit with yourself and having to, like, literally be in the house for like 2 months, I was like, you know what? Like, let me just confront these feelings and why I'm not finishing this degree. And so I just pretty much signed up for an online Spanish class and an independent study. And I did them both in around 10, 15 weeks. And I ended up graduating over Zoom, which was like such a weird experience. But yeah. And here we are. And I'm very proud of that. And I guess what I'll say too is, like, I used to feel a lot of shame about that. And I used to be like, oh my God, like, I'm not like everyone else. I didn't go to, you know, I didn't finish in 4 years and then go to grad school and get my MFA. But that's okay. And I'm actually very much at peace with the path that I've taken to get where I am, because it's included, you know, a lot of beautiful, like, memories and connections and friends and, you know, art that I wouldn't have done had I finished my degree. So I'm very, like, okay with that. And honestly, I feel like that's probably the reason why I'm able to even do what I do, is because I didn't finish and I kind of networked, I feel like, my way places. So yeah.
But it was really just that sort of almost an oversight. Well, maybe I should put it as a question. So you got the job and then you were like, you know what? I don't really have time to finish these classes. So I'm just going to put that on the back burner. Was it that kind of thing?
Pretty much. It was like that. And it was like, oh, if I get this job and I work, then, like, then I don't have to think about the fact that I didn't finish the degree on time.
Right.
And going back to finish it would be admitting that I didn't do something perfectly.
Right.
And that was what was really hard, because it was like, I'm learning to not be a perfectionist, and I get really nervous and anxious when, like, I feel like I say the wrong thing, or if I, like, mess up at work or something. Like, I beat myself up over it. And so something as big as, like, not finishing your degree on time or something that was perceived to be that big was such, in my mind at that time, a failure that I wasn't allowing myself to even, like, admit that it was a thing, you know?
Mm.
And so it took a lot of personal growth to be okay with the person that I am, to be able to say I'm comfortable enough to go back to school to finish this.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Were you getting emails, you know, saying, "Hey, Rakim, you're just 4 credits short, or, you know, whatever, 6 credits short. Do you want to sign back up or anything like that?" Or was it just like, no, it's a big system and you can just kind of fall off and nobody really notices?
It's actually kind of both. What's so funny is I actually ended up getting alumni emails, because the way that I did it was like, I remember signing up for I declared my term in 2014, but I never actually, like, submitted all the paperwork or whatever. So it processed as if, like, I was supposed to be an alumni, and I had finished all of my major classes. Right. Like, I just had, like, elective credits. So to my major, I was, like, an alumni, but not of, like, not of UCLA. So I would get things like, "Oh, you're alumni, give us money." And I'm just like, I am. Like,
right.
My loans.
Right.
And that was part of it, too. And that's part of it. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm paying these loans. I'm not even finished. Like, what is happening? But yeah, you know, that was a lot of it. And after a while, like, I just started kind of going along with it. And I was like, yeah, I'm an alumni, whatever. And I think it took a few years of really, like, of deep kind of, like, self-reflection in terms of, like, what I wanted out of my life in order for me to be like, yeah, I finished my degree late and who cares? Like, at this point, if someone has a problem with that, I don't want to work with them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, who cares? It's a piece of paper. Like, I could Photoshop what a degree looks like, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a piece of paper, and it's like, it doesn't add up to experiences. Like, there's so much that goes into that. Like, you know, like, I came out my senior year. Like, looking back, I was having symptoms of OCD and not realizing, like, what it was. And so I think the fact that I even, like, got to pass classes at all is a huge accomplishment.
Mm.
And now I look back and want to just, like, offer myself, the myself of, you know, 2014, like, some compassion, instead of beating him up and saying, you know, like, you're stupid and you're not going to amount to anything and people are smarter than you. And, like, what is, you know, that's not going to do anything. So I think at this point, like, learning to love on yourself and doing that through art has just been incredible.
Mm. That's a very prescient way of talking about your past self. There's actually a mental health/mental illness podcast that I've listened to for years. It's been around since mine. And he often asks guests, you know, who have just talked about a particularly difficult period as an adolescent, as a child, you know, whatever, early 20s, whatever. He'll say, if you could go back and talk to that person, that you, what would you say? The prompt basically being, you know, I would say nice things. I would be compassionate. And you instinctively figure that out, it sounds like.
Not instinctively. It took a lot of work, for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, my autopilot is not, like, self-compassion at all.
Right.
It's like self-sabotage.
Right. What kind of work did you do?
A lot of it was, like, okay, so it would be things like tangible things. I would say, like, meditation is a big one. Like, sitting with my feelings. Like, there's a mental health podcast I listen to called, there's one called Therapy Uncensored, and one of them was talking about, like, the best thing to do for your feelings is feel them. And so it was allowing myself to feel feelings, learning to set boundaries, not always saying yes, learning to say no.
Right.
Exposure work, like cognitive behavioral therapy, like talk therapy. I also am pretty open about the fact that I take antidepressants to manage my OCD.
Right.
And a combination of those things and like lifestyle changes, like exercise was a big one. And also I think doing self-portraiture was a way of that too, honestly. Like being able to get in front of a camera and photograph yourself, even if you don't feel like the most attractive, or, you know, if you don't feel like you look the best or your body is a certain kind of way, which I think all bodies are great. But like, I understand we all have our issues with, you know, ourselves. But yeah, you know, like doing those things and going into the shoots with like an open mind and being able to do these kind of like fabulous type poses and all of that, like that built confidence for myself. And then I think that in combination with like being around people who support you, you know, like trying to like use your mistakes as like a learning lesson. But all that, I say all that, you know, it takes practice and it takes work. Like I've been in OCD therapy for like 2 years. So it takes a, you know, it takes a lot of time, energy and effort to get through. But I think once you start to make those connections and you can start to offer that compassion to yourself, like your life changes in a way that's just kind of indescribable.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, you know, since you brought up the self-portraiture that you've been doing, I was going to ask you initially if it was, if there were certain influences, you know, and also if there was like a particular turning point, you know, that led you in that direction. But I almost feel like you kind of answered it a little bit in describing the work that you've been doing. Like, to what extent has the self-portraiture been evolved out of your working, learning to love yourself?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. I started self-portraiture when I was 16, and not because I wanted to, mostly because I didn't have friends when I was 16, and I didn't know who to photograph. So I would just, like, one of the stories that I always tell is I used to get cardboard boxes from, like, grocery stores in the morning, and I would get tape, and I would, like, tape them together to make a tripod because I couldn't work at that time. And I would like sit my camera on it and like go to the park, and I would be there for 3 hours. And that's what I would do on Saturday mornings or whatever, instead of like hanging out with people. And I used to go online and post on Flickr. Like, I don't know if people remember that, but
of course, Flickr. Flickr still exists.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Flickr from 2009 is so different from Flickr, in 2021, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it was like, I would go and like post stuff there, and I would kind of get these responses by these other artists who would, you know, make self-portraits, and people would do like a 365 project where they would take a self-portrait every day. And it was just seeing people like that. So like, there were artists on there, like, there was an artist named Olivia B that I remember. She does like these incredible like self-portraits and these really like nostalgic type photos. There was another artist named Eleanor Hardwick that I really loved. I loved white girl photographers that used vintage filters back then, so I just used to message all of them and just be like, what are you guys doing?
Right.
From there, you know, there was like a response to some of the work, and I then just started like posting it on Facebook and other places. And then in college, I would post on Instagram when that kind of came out. And And so kind of doing that has always been a way to like learn to accept myself on the journey that I'm on. I think that one of my goals right now, or one of the things that I think about a lot, is I'm never going to arrive at a point where I'm like, I'm happy now and no other problems are ever going to happen to me. So the self-portraits have been a way to document and love my body physically, like mentally, spiritually, with where I'm at that moment. So like, if I said I'm going to go into the studio at 9:00 PM and I just had like 4 burritos and I'm bloated as hell, like that's what I do, you know, because it's like, that's what I'm at that moment. And, it's just been a journey of like learning. And I also like learned a lot of like how my body works and like how to pose in certain things and like what poses don't work for me or what do. So it's a great way to like learn about yourself and like in an intimate way. It almost sounds like sexual and it's not, but but you're learning about your body in this special way. And there's a special connection that I have to my body and it feels nice, you know?
Hmm. Wow. And it sounds like you really been a true digital native as an artist, right? You know, with Flickr and beyond, you know, that like you put your work up, you know, you got feedback, there was a certain community element to it and so on, right? And then you expanded with Instagram and whatnot. It just feels like, it feels like you've been able to take advantage of that, of those platforms as far as getting feedback, using it as a platform, you know, for your work, as opposed to, you know, the pre-digital era when people were, you know, nobody saw their work.
Yeah. I remember hearing a story of, I forgot who, I think it was Ryan McGinley. You asked about inspirations. He's like a huge one.
Okay.
And like Ernie Barnes as well. I remember hearing a story. I don't know if this is true or not, but I remember hearing a story of him making like these magazines and just like mailing it to all of these people. And that's kind of how he got his start. Mm. And luckily I was coming up at a time where where the internet and Twitter and Instagram, like when they first started and Instagram was like chronological and all of that before Facebook bought it. And I was on Tumblr a lot too. So like I would post things on there and kind of built community that way. I met a lot of like queer men, a lot of like queer artists, like dated a lot of people from the internet, went on a lot of dates, like made a lot of work. Like it was a really messy, fun time. But that time really helped, you know, like kind of build, I don't want to say a following because that sounds weird, but like I guess that's the word I'm going to say, sure. A following.
Sure.
And it's been great. And so seeing people that have been supporting the work and seeing it evolve from when I've been in college, like working with, you know, modeling agencies to doing self-portraiture to now, it's pretty incredible because there are people that will message me and be like, you know, I remember when you were doing this like 5 years ago or 6 years ago. And it's so incredible to see what's been happening. And so it feels crazy to like finally now kind of come into yourself after almost what feels like a decade or pretty much was a decade. Since leaving high school till now. Oh, wow. It's been a decade.
Yeah, wow. A little over.
Yeah.
A little over, actually, right?
Hmm?
I said a little over a decade even, right?
A little over. Yeah, 11 years. Yeah.
Yeah. When you were doing all that dating you described, were you meeting most of those people on the platforms, like the where you were doing your work, or was it a combination of that and other platforms?
It was a combination of things, but I would always tell people that if I photograph you, I won't date you, and if I date you, I won't photograph you. So there, that was
right. Good boundaries. That was,
yeah, because you know, it's looking back, that was a boundary because I did not want to be a photographer because at that time I only really did photos, and I did not want to be someone who was known for kind of like sleeping with their, you know, like subjects and like all of that drama stuff. Like I very much wanted it to be about the work. But sometimes, like, you would photograph someone or, like, you would meet someone on set or whatever, and they were really nice. Or I would, you know, like any other gay man in their early 20s, like, I was on Grindr and Scruff and all of that. And that inspired a lot of the work, you know? You know, being told you're not attractive enough, you're not this, you're not that, you know, by other people, other Black people, too. Like, and it sucked. So I was making work about, you know, what my body was. And a lot of times it was kind of overly sexual because I wanted to feel like I was able to be attractive in that kind of way.
Hmm. Was part of that, do you think part of that was a sort of F you to them, to some of those people who said those things to you?
For sure. But I kind of look back now and I feel kind of sad about that because I was making work to prove to other people something that I already knew to myself. I didn't need to make all these self portraits like that were, you know, designed to kind of be like in between, like, you know, sexualized photos and like art portraits. And I did it because I wanted to feel like I, like the work I was making mattered. And, you know, mind you, like I didn't have my degree at this time. Like I was still, like I'm still living at home. And so my self-esteem was like not that great. And so that was my way of kind of telling myself, you know, Rakim, like you matter. Like, and looking back, it was just defining my worth based off of like my circumstances at the time and not the person that I am. So it's tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going back to what you were talking about with the boundaries, you know, as a, mm-hmm. as a self-portrait photographer or photographer of models who mm-hmm. you wouldn't date if you photographed and vice versa. It made me think of Robert Mapplethorpe. By any chance, have you seen that documentary of him from fairly recently?
I have not seen the documentary, but I did see the last show that he did at LACMA. Mm-hmm. And I'm like familiar with him.
Right.
Yeah.
I asked because, as you, I'm sure you know, he had mm-hmm. Relationships with or sex in a lot of cases with
yeah.
a lot of his models. And I just found, I mean, that aside, really, I just found what I got from his story to be a little unsettling.
I don't really like him, honestly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I think largely, really, from his sort of, which was not uncommon, I think, in that time. I don't know. Maybe it's still a thing, but his sort of drive was just so sociopathic, almost. You know, it was just so extreme. Like he would do anything to make it big.
Almost feel like with him, my issue with Mapplethorpe comes from the fact that like I feel like the way he photographs black people can come off as very like fetishy and like right. fetishizing and right. like, and so as like a black gay man who's like doing photography, like it's weird because like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, like Rakim, your work reminds me, and I'm like, like, you know, because, but at the same time, I could see the comparisons because I was kind of sexualizing myself, like in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think what he did was kind of use black people sometimes, I think, as objects and not necessarily like as people. And I feel like that happens, like a lot of black men and a lot of gay black men are kind of just looked at as like sex objects. And it's just like, you know, that's, I have issues with that. And in terms of like doing things to make it big, like that's, I think that's, stuff people need to go to therapy for.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I'd be curious to know what you think if you get a chance to see that documentary, because there's a lot more sort of backstory to his career, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, about the models, I think that while that's true, I think he was an equal opportunity sort of objectifier, you know, because he did it with pretty much all his models, you know.
Yeah, I think though that there's like a it's more of like there's a dynamic that happens that I can't really ignore when mm-hmm. it's like mm-hmm. white photographers like photographing black men in that way, like
right.
and it goes, you know, and it's like and it's hard, you know, like and it's something that I like reconcile or like I think of, not reconcile, but something that I like think about pretty often.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes I worry that the work that I'm doing is being viewed like in that way, but I have to kind of catch myself because that's not really like my problem. You know, like if people want to fetishize or whatever the work that I'm doing, like that's them. Like
yeah.
I'm not doing that.
Right.
Or at least that's not my intention. And at some point I think we kind of just have to like we let go of ownership of work sometimes when we put it out into the world. So I'm trying to be a little bit like better about that, but
right.
yeah.
Yeah. But for anybody who's paying attention, it's clear that you've done a lot of work and thought about the subject to know, you know, to have a sense of control over, you know, to what extent you might be fetishizing and that you sort of eliminate that element.
I think now it's definitely something that I try to be conscious of. I think my opinion of nudity has shifted a lot. Like, partially because antidepressants kill your sex drive, but right. I'm starting to look at my body as more than like a sexual object, and I'm looking at it as more of like a temple, like, but sex is like included in that, obviously. Like, I'm not saying sex is like a bad thing and nudity is not like a bad thing, but I've learned, I was tired of only sharing like the part of myself that was sexual. And so I wanted to start like making conscious efforts to do like other, to find ways to incorporate like nudity into it that wasn't as like in your face, you know, like here's some ass type of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think now that there's like a good, I think now there's like a good balance. And if I feel like going in the studio one day and making a work that's sexual, or if I want to do whatever, like then I'll do that too. But where I'm at right now, I'm trying to like investigate other parts of, you know, who I am, because there's more to me than that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So to go back to kind of where we were at the beginning, you alluded to that you're moving out. Mm-hmm. Soon. So you, what can we talk about that for a minute? So you're moving in with somebody, and how long have you been seeing each other, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah. I am moving in with my partner. We're looking right now. We've been dating for 2.5 years for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And he's great. Mm-hmm. I don't want to embarrass him too much. but yeah, you know, like, I think he's pretty amazing, and he's so supportive, and I really can't like ask for a better partner. You know, we both have had to learn to support each other in different ways. We've had to learn to communicate. We've had to learn to, learn each other's quirks. And I think moving in is going to be such like a, like, nice step, because we both, I think, have had like a lack of like our own space. And so getting to create our own space and getting to define what that is very, very exciting. And I can't wait for it.
Yeah. So yeah. You guys are in the looking process?
Yeah, we mm-hmm. know like the area that we want to go in, and we are kind of like, we've done a few like kind of calls and visits and whatnot. But since I'm like planning a show at the same time, so we're trying to like, you know, like manage both of those things.
Right.
So yeah.
So you might really finalize things after your show is up or done or both.
Yeah, yeah. Kinda. It really just depends on like timeline stuff, because it's like doing that and then, you know, working and like all at the same time is just like a lot. And I'm not trying to like, you know, stress myself out to the point of like not eating or something like that.
Yeah, I know.
It's like halfway points between our jobs. Like our main focus is like commuting times.
Right.
And so we just don't want to have to drive like an hour to get to work. So it's more of like a, where can we find that? Like we both have like a reasonable, you know, amount of time.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little house/ apartment hunting advice for what it's worth.
Oh, please do.
This is a little bit bigger picture, but do some research into whoever the prospective landlord is, because I've been part of the tenants union for the last couple of years, the LA Tenants Union, the West Side Local, actually, and there are some companies that are definitely bad, so that you want to avoid. So a combination of like looking a little bit, do a little research on who, you know, the reputation of the landlord, the management company that owns the building, and if you can, ask even some of the your potential neighbors, you know, like what their experience has been, because that is ultimately invaluable to wherever you land.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I oh my God, it'll be and whenever it happens, I'll like send you pictures of the setup or whatever. But I'm very excited about it, and you know, it'll be nice, and it's like, it'll just be nice to like come home and not have to like hear anything.
any of your family? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's gonna be an interesting transition in your life, isn't it?
It is, you know, but like I'm really grateful for it, and transitions tend to be more stressful for me, especially with OCD. It tends to attack those things, but it's going to be a really good time. And, you know, even if like, you know, it ends up being a horrible experience, like moving or whatever, like I think I'm at a place in my life where, like, I'm at peace with that, or, like, I can handle it because I'm just more proud of the fact that, like, I'm doing or like, making these decisions. And it's, like, I know for a lot of people, it's, like, oh, I've been, like, living on my own since I've been 18, whatever. But it's, like, okay, for me, that wasn't my story. So, like, the fact that I'm able to do it now, you know, it's I feel really great about it.
You're going to be ready for it.
I really am. Yeah. Like, I say that, and then life's probably going to, like, kick my ass and humble me. Like,
yeah, but you'll be prepared. You'll be prepared for that.
For sure.
You've been around the block, so I think you got it covered.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you, Rakim. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're out.